characterize it, but I do not feel we've gotten the whole truth from the administration throughout the family separation policy, and I think there's bombshells still to come.
Lee Gallant, I want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Director of the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, lead lawyer for the ACLU's national challenge to the Trump administration's family separation practice. Democracy Now! Has a job opening, full-time, one-year paid news production fellowship. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is your 5 o'clock news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of First Thursday at Street Roots on Thursday, February 7th from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Street Roots office in Portland. Street Roots will be hosting a First Thursday gallery exhibition honoring the late Terry Hofton, featuring newly discovered paintings and collages. There will also be a poetry reading and more. Again, that's First Thursday at Street Roots on Thursday, February 7th from 4 to 8 p.m. at the Street Roots office, 211 Northwest Davis Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the screening of the documentary film Big Money Agenda on Sunday, February 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Big Money Agenda explores the effects of money in politics, Citizens United, as well as solutions to the issues of money in politics that's preventing real change. There will also be a discussion after the film. Again, that's the screening of the documentary film Big Money Agenda on Sunday, February 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from True West, presenting The Motet, February 16th at the Roseland Theater. This is a 21 and over event. Tickets and more information is available online at roselandpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland moves forward with a homeless service center in downtown, an anti-abortion law in Louisiana is tabled by the Supreme Court, and in international news, we will get a live report from Venezuela. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 8th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Alex Riedlinger. Multnomah County has moved forward with a $5.8 million deal for a homeless services center downtown. The center will be located in the Bushing & Co. Company located at 333 Southwest Park Avenue. Board of Commissioners on Thursday unanimously approved a purchase and sale agreement to begin formal negotiations to buy the four-story building. The agreement gives the county 30 days to conduct due diligence evaluations and an additional 30 days to close on the estimated $4.3 million sale. County officials say the facility will be a day center providing access to phones and computers, and tend to basics like getting a meal and taking a shower. The most important goal of the facility will be to offer support to homeless people provided by former homeless people. The facility will be staffed by those with lived experience with homelessness, mental health issues, and substance abuse issues.
Well, you've probably heard that the forecast in Portland shows severe weather hitting us for the next several days. Even if we don't see that much precipitation, sub-freezing temperatures are expected through most of next week. Emergency conditions have been declared, and overnight warming shelters in Montevilla and at Sunnyside Community House are open. Severe weather shelters do not require identification or any other documentation. No one seeking shelter during severe weather will be turned away, and more sites will open as needed. The Portland Assembly prepared this short piece reminding all of us that we don't need to wait on others to respond to crisis.
Every winter, the threat to people living outside increases, and it can be difficult to figure out how to respond as a community. When we think about addressing the problems of houselessness and land access as individuals, it seems impossible. So we form groups of like-minded people who can work together to respond to the current conditions with material programs. Those groups can further work to change those conditions and address root causes of oppression under capitalism. What you need to start a warming shelter. Find a space. Churches or community centers in your area may be willing to open up. See if there's an existing day shelter program in your area that might be willing to expand services. Reach out to people you know. 5 to 10 people are needed as a core group. You'll need unlimited volunteers. Seriously, sign up everyone you can. Find groups and organizations that intersect with the needs of your community. Call a meeting of involved groups and individuals. Stock up. Send out a call to your community for donations and volunteers.
You can go to tinyurl.com/sunnysideovernight to volunteer or donate to the Sunnyside Warming Shelter. You can also call 211 to get the latest warming shelter information in other areas of the state.
A new poll estimates that 70% of Portland voters support electing city council members by geographic district, according to a report in the Portland Tribune. That is a 16 percentage point increase over a 2016 poll, which pegged support at 54%. The at-large system of elections has been used to suppress minorities since the start of the United States. Back in 1842, six states still elected their U.S. representatives with statewide elections. In that year, Congress put an end to this practice at the federal level and birthed gerrymandering by requiring that representatives be elected by districts composed of contiguous territory. In the aftermath of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, most U.S. cities also stopped the use of racist at-large elections. The Portland poll also reports that half of voters feel that the quality is getting worse, with housing costs and bad traffic often cited.
In Washington, D.C. today, the Senate Judiciary Committee has voted William Barr, Trump's nominee for Attorney General, out of committee and onward to full Senate confirmation. The committee also approved 44 Trump-selected judges to serve lifetime appointments on the federal bench. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under law said that this shows the Senate Judiciary Committee has failed to carry out its constitutional obligation to provide advice and consent on the president's judicial nominees. Instead, the group says the committee has short-circuited the review process and rubber-stamped dozens of nominees. The committee has condemned the Senate Judiciary Committee's decision to blindly advance judicial nominees, many of whom are radical and outside the legal mainstream.
The Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker appeared before Congress members this morning in Washington, D.C., and faced questions about potential interference in Robert Mueller's investigation. Mueller is investigating possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government in the lead-up to the 2016 election. In response to questioning from House Judiciary Committee members, Whitaker stated that he has not denied any funding requests made by the Mueller investigation. But he did push back against the questioning, telling one Congress member his, quote, 5 minutes were up, end quote, which led to audible gasps inside the hearing room.
An online petition demanding the release of rapper 21 Savage has reached more than 200,000 signatures. The petition was created by Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Khan Coulours and supported by various other organizations. It says that 21 Savage has no current or prior criminal convictions and says it is shameful that he and so many black immigrants are separated from their families on a daily basis as part of the U.S. government's heartless and racist immigration policies. In a statement released earlier this week, his legal team said the performer was born in the United Kingdom and came to the United States at age 7. He returned to the United Kingdom for about a month in 2005, then came back to the U.S. He's currently imprisoned in an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility pending deportation proceedings.
The U.S. Supreme Court has decided to block an unconstitutional anti-abortion law from Louisiana, with Roe v. Wade and women's right to sovereignty over their bodies remaining in place for now. Although the Louisiana law will not go into effect tomorrow as planned, the Supreme Court has not yet made a final ruling. First passed in 2014, the Louisiana law requires doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. Women's rights advocates say that if this law is allowed to stand, it will force Louisiana women to go out of the state for medical care. This places an unfair burden not only on women in Louisiana seeking this legal procedure, but also on neighboring states. That includes Texas, where an identical law was ruled unconstitutional only 2 years ago.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News at 5:30 p.m. It is the Community Report. At 6 p.m., it's Evergreen. Then at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather, cloudy with rain and snow. Low of 31 degrees. Winds are at 10 to 20 miles per hour. The chance of precipitation sitting at 100%. Tomorrow's weather, mainly cloudy. Snow showers around in the morning. High of 34 degrees. That's the high, 34. With winds at 15 to 25 miles per hour, the chance of snow sits at 50%. Today in Black history, figure skater Debbie Thomas became the first Black American to win the women's singles at the U.S. Figure Skating Championships. And our quote of the day is from, quote, "I tell people I'm too stupid to know what's impossible. I have ridiculously large dreams, and half the time they come true."
A group of kids suing the federal government over climate change has filed a motion asking the court to block federal approvals of fossil fuel development. The 24 plaintiffs in the case Juliana versus the United States made their extraordinary motion in a filing late Thursday in the Ninth Court of Appeals. They're asking the court to immediately block the federal government from approving any coal mining on federal land. They are also asking that all new oil or natural gas drilling facilities and fossil fuel infrastructure like pipelines be blocked as long as the case is still in court. The young people who filed the lawsuit are demanding government action on climate change, arguing that their futures are at risk. They've already made it past lower court hurdles in a number of states, including Oregon, but the government keeps appealing, and it's likely that the case will end up in the Supreme Court. The attorneys cited research showing that fossil fuels on federal lands resulted in 1.3 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions in 2014, and production has only increased since then. The case was filed in 2015, and the federal government has repeatedly asked higher courts, including the Supreme Court, to stop the case. The Supreme Court has twice refused to do so, and lower court judges have upheld the children's right to a clean energy future.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some tribes in Oregon are reclaiming land and gaining recognition for their sustainable management practices. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Since last year, several tribes in Oregon have had thousands of acres restored through the Western Oregon Tribal Fairness Act or been given oversight of their own forests. Darren Jarnigan, Natural Resources Director for the Coquille Tribe, says this helps protect traditional native plants.
The Coquille Tribe wants to make sure that members have access to historically what was here on the landscape for tribal purposes. The wildlife, the plant communities, the bear grasses, the hazels, the camas, plants that the tribal members come and use and expect to be here when we're done managing the landscape.
Don Motanik of the Intertribal Timber Council says independent assessments are shared with Congress every 10 years, comparing tribally managed forests with those managed by the federal government. These have highlighted two big differences.
One is that tribal forestry programs function at one-third of the cost as compared to the Forest Service. It's $9 an acre for the Forest Service and $3 an acre for tribes. The second key point they make is that tribes are models of sustainability because some of the programs have been in existence over 100 years.
And the latest farm bill has provisions that will boost tribes' management of forests, which could include federal ones adjacent to their reservations. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
An exhibit is showcasing photos believed to be the first photos of Southeast Alaska and the Tlingit people. KNBA's Trip Krause talks with the curator about the historical context of the photos.
My Bridge in Alaska collects a number of photographs originally taken in 1868 from a Tarawal expedition taken by Edward My Bridge. The show's curator, Mark Schaefer, attended the debut of the show at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage.
And they're the first photographs ever taken that we know of Tlingit people, and the first photographs ever taken of Sitka and of the Southeast region. So they have a lot of historical value, and for Tlingit people in particular, obviously, a lot of cultural value.
The photographs include depictions of Fort Tongass, Fort Wrangell, and Sitka.
They're original, so they were produced in 1868, 1869. But they're also windows into a time that's very important in the history of the state and the history of Native people.
The photos were taken with a single camera and two lenses. The side-by-side images are meant to be viewed with a device that helps blend the two images into one, creating almost a three-dimensional image. The exhibit will be on display at the Heritage Center through March, before it moves to Haines and later to Sitka. In Anchorage, I'm Tripp Krause.
A bill on missing and murdered Indigenous women advanced in the Nebraska legislature this week. The legislation calls for a study and data collection by the State Patrol. It would require the State Patrol to work with tribal, local, and federal agencies to identify barriers, examine ways to provide state resources to address the issue, and recommendations to improve the reporting of missing Native American women in Nebraska. Other states are considering similar legislation, including in Washington, which builds on legislation passed in the state last year to address the issue. This week, Native Americans testified in support of a bill in Kansas to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day. Lawmakers are considering the bill, introduced by Representatives Dennis Heiberger and Ponkawee Victors, to change the holiday statewide. In recent years, cities including Lawrence and Kansas City have moved to celebrate Indigenous people on the second Monday in October. The bill did not get a hearing last year. Lawmakers in other states are also seeking statewide change of the holiday, including in New Mexico, where similar legislation advanced this week. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Tonight, we are fortunate to have a live report from Venezuela. In the latest headlines from the country, the Venezuelan military has blocked a major highway out of Venezuela that is connecting Venezuela and Colombia. The blockade was built on Wednesday, just 24 hours after Venezuela's opposition released plans to bring humanitarian aid across the country's southern border with Colombia. Some humanitarian aid groups have criticized the opposition's plan, which they say appears to be a political tool in the fight for Venezuela's presidency. Caritas, a Catholic humanitarian organization operating in Venezuela, says that aid should not be deployed to serve political interests, but should benefit the most vulnerable people. A little later on this morning, this evening, we will hopefully be talking with Juan Dobson. He's a journalist with the website VenezuelaAnalysis.com. He is located in Venezuela, so we are having a bit of difficulty making that connection happen. Once it does, we will definitely talk to him. He is based in Mérida in western Venezuela. In the meantime, we will move on with a story about a Saudi journalist, an update on that story. United Nations-led inquiry into the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi has found substantial evidence that Saudi officials planned and executed the murder. The journalist was killed in October at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul when he went to the consulate to get pages added to his passport. The UN inquiry found that officials from high up in the Saudi government, possibly the Crown Prince himself, ordered the execution of the outspoken journalist. The Saudi government then tried to cover up the crime. Following the release of the report, top lawmakers in both parties in the U.S. Congress revived a call to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for the murder of Khashoggi. Bernie Sanders led the call on the Democratic side, unveiling legislation Thursday that would block U.S. arms sales to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Well, it appears that we have got Juan Dobson, a journalist with VenezuelaAnalysis.com, back on the line with us. We do want to have the opportunity to ask him some questions about the situation down there. Juan, thank you for joining us on KABU this evening. And we're trying to make sure that connection is up and running. And hopefully we'll be able to talk to him shortly. In the meantime, wanted to get back to that story with regard to the Saudi journalist and finish that up for you. Wanted to let you know that the bill will impose mandatory sanctions on those found responsible for his death. The senators pointed to inaction by the Trump administration as the reason that Congress needs to step in and take action in holding the Saudi monarchy responsible. This includes Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has attempted to prevent and undermine the investigation into Khashoggi's killing. All right, we have been successful in getting Juan Dobson on the phone. Juan, are you there with us? Hello?
Yeah, good to be with you.
Yes, hi. Oh, great. We finally have you. Thank you so much for joining us on Cable. We apologize for the technical difficulties.
No problem.
All right. My name is Michelle Coppola, and again, we're happy to have you here. I want to start out with the first question. Here in the U.S., you know, it is difficult to get verified information about what's actually happening in Venezuela, especially with the U.S. government now recognizing the coup government of Juan Guaido within minutes of its declaration. Can you speak to that and give us a real assessment of what's happening there?
Yeah, well, there's a significant barrier being put in place by the mainstream media, and obviously in the United States, you're victim to this more so than other peoples across the world. It's important to underline that the coup d'etat, which is being carried out in Venezuela, is very much a coup d'etat of international relations. Here in Venezuela, nothing has changed. We've seen no significant power shift, which would suggest that the Juan Guaido is currently in charge of the country. We've seen no state institutions recognizing him. We've seen, obviously, the armed forces not recognizing him. And obviously, the vast majority of the people have continued to back the government as they did before. Things are very calm here in Venezuela at the moment. We are seeing a few protests and rallies held by both pro-government and anti-government forces. But there's nothing to indicate that there is a shift of power in the country.
So it doesn't appear that there is actually one side being more supported than the other at this point. It seems fairly evenly divided, or no?
I would say that's a fair assessment. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously very difficult to judge exactly. But if you look at the recent demonstrations held in the capital, Caracas, over the last few weeks, there are very similar sizes, both very well attended. And obviously, this is not being better reflected by mainstream media. It's a covering to see the white or mostly white upper middle class supporters of Juan Guaido, and then not covering the thousands and millions who continue to support the Bolivarian project here in Venezuela.
Well, very interesting. Alex, my co-anchor, had a question for you.
Greetings. Can you give a brief assessment of the situation on the ground regarding the protests? You were mentioning anti-government protests as well as counter-protests. We were just wondering, are the protests in the street for Guaido or incumbent Nicolas Maduro, how are they represented in terms of the party politics? The opposition parties outside of Guaido's party, are they out in the streets as well?
Yes, they are, although some major opposition parties are being quite quiet about their support for him, I think we could say. It's important to understand that the Venezuelan right-wing forces are very heavily divided between those who wish to play within the legal and democratic constitutional norms of the country and those which have thrown in the towel with these sorts of strategies and are now looking to extra legal methods to achieve their political goals. Juan Guaido very much comes from the second of these two groups. His party has a history of extra legal and violent at times action to try to become to political power. And the other sections of the right wing in Venezuela, the democratic group, we could say, are tacitly supporting him, but are definitely not spearheading his efforts to try and overthrow the elected government.
So you mentioned this a little earlier after my first question, but as you said, U.S. media agencies have been very quick to characterize Maduro's government as illegitimate. But wasn't he democratically elected last year? Or do we have that wrong? I mean, despite a boycott of the election by the opposition, is our information incorrect here? Or
well, instead of giving you my opinion, what I can do is give you the opinion of the numerous independent electoral observers who were in Venezuela at the time, last May 20th, when, yes, indeed, he was elected by the people of Venezuela. these independent electoral observers declared the election free and fair and transparent, you know, including we had some North American mayors and the representatives here in person observing the election themselves. The elections are really under a spotlight right now, but it's worth pointing out that there was a partial boycott of opposition forces, but in fact nearly 17 opposition parties did participate, and they had two different candidates. Now the fact that they weren't able to win any election did not delegitimize the electoral process in itself, no? But this is also a line which Washington is trying to push. But I would encourage all of your listeners to not even take my word for it, to look on the internet at VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and you can find the original wording and original report by the independent electoral observers, and you can see what they say about the electoral process.
So we've been hearing reports of military planes bringing weapons into the country from Miami. Is there anything to that claim?
There were claims over the last 48 hours, but these planes, whether they actually existed or not, definitely did not arrive into Venezuela. What we have seen 2 days ago was a commercial flight which actually brought in a significant number of arms which were seized by the Venezuelan authorities in the airport of Valencia in the west of Venezuela. Some very heavy armory tried to be smuggled into the country from the United States, and this was obviously seized. But this sort of incident really fuels the talk about humanitarian aid on the Venezuelan border. The Venezuelan government has accused humanitarian aid of being a cover-up for the smuggling in of both weapons, mercenaries, and essentially trying to spark a war in their continent. And so these sort of incidents where we see very real evidence of arms being smuggled in from the United States only add logs onto this fire.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you're quite aware, as most of our listeners are quite aware, the U.S. has a very long history in Latin America, not all of it laudable for sure. Can you talk a little bit about the history of U.S. intervention in Venezuela in particular and how that's contributed to the crisis that's in your country right now?
Well, it's not a particularly glowing history of United States intervention in Venezuela, even well before 1999 when politics changed quite dramatically. But let's look at the last 20 years or so. We've got obviously the clear example of the U.S. financed coup d'etat in 2002, which succeeded in overthrowing the elected government for a period of 48 hours before being overturned by a rebellion of the soldiers and the popular forces. Since then, we've seen a series of U.S.-related incidents in the country, the oil lockout of 2004, for example, and various street violence which has been promoted by the United States and the political party of Juan Guaido himself in 2014 and 2017. And the most recent example, at least according to government sources, is the last August, the drone terrorist attack against Nicolas Maduro. It seems that the terrorist cell which organized this attempt on his life definitely had some connections with citizens in Miami and potentially some funding from U.S. organisms as well. So this is a most recent example before January 23rd of U.S. meddling in Venezuelan democracy and Venezuela's sovereign politics.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being with us this evening, Juan. If you would, hang on the line after we get done. Again, we've been speaking with Juan Dobson, a journalist with the website VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We encourage you to go to that site if you'd like to know more about this subject, which changes every moment. Thank you again, Juan.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 8th, 2019. Here are the main points again. Portland is moving forward with a homeless service center in downtown. An anti-abortion law in Louisiana is tabled by the Supreme Court. And in international news, reports of a military blockade in Venezuela. We just heard details about that. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Meyer, myself, Michelle Coppola, Jenka Soderberg as well. The producer is Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. That's KBOO Portland. Also at K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Alex Riedlinger.
And coming up tomorrow on KBOO in the morning, and we do have our promos for tomorrow. Lots happening on KBOO in the morning, and we will get to that in just a moment. Okay. So make sure you're listening to AM News in the morning, and they will have all the details about the latest on the snowpocalypse that may or may not happen here in the Portland area. And again, just a reminder, if you are houseless, if you are without shelter during this cold weather, you want to make sure you call 211 for the latest information on how to seek shelter during this weather, and that is the KBOO PM News. Community Roundtable is next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Yeah, we can all talk though.
Talk to him again?
Yep.
Oh.